Great. Okay, so let's make a start. So before I introduce our speaker today, I've got the boring admin task of attendance sheet for those who have to attend. And if you have to attend, then you know that you have to sign there. Okay, well, thank you all for coming and welcome. And I'm delighted that we have Mark Sideris here today, who's going to talk to us about Buddhist physicalism. So, in fact, this is a series of three lectures. There's the one today, which is more or less self-contained, but then there's more discussion of similar material in two lectures tomorrow, one at 10:30 and one at 2 o'clock, also in here, the same place. I don't know whether Mark actually invented the term fusion philosophy, but he certainly used the term a lot to describe what he's doing. And today and tomorrow we'll have a very nice example of fusion philosophy, which is trying to combine a largely Abhidharma outlook with a naturalist or physicalist conception of reality. And I think this is quite an interesting project because it raises a number of intriguing questions. I mean, the first is like a more historical question. It's a question, of course, that the Buddhists always try to refute the materialists or the Charvaka. So did they get it all wrong? And is Abhidharma in the end compatible with physicalism? So that's one question you might ask here. And the second question is, of course, more general. What does it actually mean to link up a religious tradition like Buddhism with the naturalist, materialist tradition that we usually associate with a kind of secular framework? So if we want to think that ideas like, you know, liberation or nirvana or nirvana are central ideas within Buddhism, then what would the physicalist equivalent of all of that be? Well, I hope we'll get some insight into some of these questions in one of these three lectures starting today. So so before I hand over to Mark, I think Mark is going to talk somewhat under an hour, and then around 3 o'clock, I think the remains of the tea will appear in the back, and then we'll have about, there are handouts over there, and then we'll have about half an hour for discussion, and then we can move over to the refreshments. So without further ado, thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you, Jan, and thank you all for coming. Those of you who did not have to come today, thank you. And those of you who had to come because you enrolled in the seminar, my apologies in advance if I fail to meet the high expectations I know Mr. Lester Hoff has set for you. Okay, note the question mark. That's very important. I am exploring a question in these lectures. This is a project I've been involved in for quite some time, and I've got a lot of thoughts about how it might go, but it's still a question. Could there be such a thing as a Buddhist physicalism? Now, as Jan already indicated, the idea of a Buddhist physicalism might be conceived as part of a project of trying to naturalize Buddhism or modernize it. All of the major religions are faced with this issue that began in the mid to late 19th century and is an ongoing issue of how to deal with a world culture that now takes the natural sciences as having pride of place when it comes to telling us about what the world is really like. Used to be that major religions saw that as their job description, but for many people today, it's the natural sciences. And so, okay, to naturalize phenomenon is to try to make that phenomenon compatible with what the natural sciences seem to tell us. And in response to that, well, the Dalai Lama, for instance, at one point described Buddhism as a 2,500-year-old mind science, trying to at least suggest that Buddhism, unlike Western monotheistic religions is not faced with a real problem of naturalization or modernizing in face of the role of the rise of the natural sciences, because it is already scientific. It's just simply investigating a different sphere from the sphere that the natural sciences contend with. Now, when it comes to trying to modernize or naturalize Buddhism in particular, some people have embraced this project and others criticize it in all sorts of ways. We'll go into all of that, but one common criticism is precisely that doing so would undermine significant, serious elements of the Buddhist project. Now, when I talk about physicalism, what I mean is a physicalism understood as a serious ontological project. Now, serious ontology, that's a term of art in metaphysics, in philosophy. And what that amounts to is trying to figure out what truly exists, what the basic structure of reality is, independently of the concepts that we happen to use, the ways in which we have come to understand the world through acceptance of a common sense framework. So you can distinguish between folk ontology and the philosophical subdiscipline called serious ontology. A folk ontology is just the kinds of things that ordinary people would agree exist, are part of the world. And up until fairly recently, you might say, when it comes to folk metaphysics, folk ontology, it is dualist in nature. That is, sees a distinction to be drawn between physical things and mental things, the mind and the body. And that's been a natural split in ordinary common sense thinking about us in particular for quite some time. But increasingly, as the notion of the mind as the brain and the brain as like a computer, the rise of AI, similar sorts of phenomena, we wind up becoming increasingly tempted by what we could call folk physicalism. There's really nothing more to reality than just the body, including the brain. The brain is a very, very powerful computing device, and it works through physical processes that are scientifically, neurologically comprehensible. Now, serious ontology is a result not of simply listening to what people say, how people talk, what sorts of things people's talk seems to commit them to, but is rather the result of analysis. Standing back, standing away from the ways in which we talk that may reflect what's useful for us, may reflect our traditions, our cultural traditions, and trying to, through rigorous conceptual analysis and argumentation, figure out what truly exists. So that's the distinction. Now, physicalism, as I'm going to be using the term, is a serious ontological thesis. In particular, it's the thesis that all that really exists is physical, but what do I mean by physical? Well, okay, borrowing from Willard Van Orman Quine, who said to be is to be the value of a bound variable, take the laws of final physics, whatever that turns out to be. Imagine, for instance, that Newtonian mechanics had been final physics. It's not, but imagine it was. Well, then mass would be one of the things that is mentioned in the laws of Newtonian mechanics, and so mass would be something that had to go in our final ontology. Occurrences of mass here, there, different space-time points. Okay. Now, I use the expression final physics. What does that mean? Well, I have no idea what final physics is. No one does now. We know that physics is not complete. Newtonian mechanics, many people thought for a long time, was the end. That's all we need to know. But then, of course, there was Maxwell's discussion of his analysis of electromagnetism, et cetera, et cetera. And now we've got relativity theory and quantum mechanics at war with one another. Nobody knows how to put the two together to come up with a unified theory, and that's what the physicists want. So, could there be a final physics? We don't know. We don't know what shape it might take. We don't even know if there will be such a thing. Nonetheless, given the history of the natural sciences in the last several centuries, there is some reason to suppose that there may well be. It looks like it's we're on a promising trajectory. Now, understood as serious ontology, physicalismists claim we don't need to suppose there is anything more to reality than just whatever are mentioned in the laws of final physics. Okay, so that's what I'm going to mean by physicalism. Everything else, all the things that are not mentioned in final physics, in the law, their laws, but is in our folk ontology. Well, why is it in our folk ontology? Because we've found it useful to talk about such things, to imagine that there really are such things. And so that will turn out to be something that can be explained in terms of the laws of final physics and the entities that the laws of final physics say that there are. So the parts of our common sense ontology, our folk ontology, that get left out of final physics, and that'll be most everything, those things can come back in by way of understanding, well, those are things that we believe exist for a reason, because it's useful for us, given how things really are according to physics, how things really are, it's useful for us to talk about and think as if there are such things. That's the basic idea. Now, this Buddhist physicalism question mark project has to do with trying to maybe perhaps prevent Dharmageddon. Okay. The Buddha is said to have prophesied that sooner or later the Buddhist teachings would be forgotten, and Buddhism as we know it would disappear, and then eventually another Buddha would show up and teach exactly the same laws. Now, in Japanese, that's known as Mappo, the decline of the Dharma, the whole. Most major religions are faced with the difficulty of squaring themselves with the results of the natural sciences, given this naturalizing tendency in our cultures. And I'm obviously an American, and in the United States we see all sorts of nice little illustrations of the difficulties, the hoops that the leaders of various religions find themselves in trying to pull this off. And so you get, for instance, in parts of the Southeast United States, there is a museum that shows that the dinosaurs aren't around anymore simply because they couldn't get a Noah's Ark. Okay, so that's why there were once dinosaurs, but the world is really only 19,000 years old. Okay, that's the sort of thing, the sort of struggle that some of the major, particularly Western monotheistic religions, are faced with in trying to naturalize, square their claims with. And the question is, what happened? Does Buddhism necessarily face just exactly the same sort of problem? And, okay. Now, I don't pretend that any of the classical Indian Buddhists, Buddhist philosophers, Buddhist meditation masters, and so on, subscribed to this thing called Buddhist physicalism. They didn't. They were robustly, uniformly anti-physicalist. Now, what Indian Buddhist philosophers were up to is, would count as what I'm calling serious ontology. They wanted to know what is reality like independently of our wants, needs, and interests, independently of the concepts we happen to employ because of our cognitive limitations. Okay, they were doing serious ontology. That's why some of us philosophers love exploring the Buddhist philosophical tradition. Now, the one exception to that claim of Buddhist philosophy as serious ontology is Majjhimaka. Majjhimaka is, as I understand it, global anti-realism. That means the question of serious ontology is illegitimate. Forget it. It doesn't make any sense. Okay. And that's part of the Majjhimaka understanding of the Buddhist soteriological project, how we overcome suffering, how we achieve the cessation of suffering. With the exception of Majjhimaka, what you find in classical Indian Buddhist philosophy is dualism and a form of idealism, which is, of course, a monism. Dualism, that is mind-body dualism, and idealism, there is no body, there's just the mind. Now, I'm going to stick with the claim that Yogacara constitutes idealism in spite of the fact that there are some scholars of Yogacara who claim that they were just doing phenomenology, they were not doing metaphysics at all. I disagree with that. So, now, there were materialists on the scene when the classical Indian Buddhist philosophers were doing their thing, and the Charvaka school, they were materialists. They claimed that there are only four elements. We would say that there are, what is it, 98 naturally occurring elements, and then all the others that you can create by jamming subatomic particles together. Earth, air, water, and fire, that's all you really need. It doesn't really matter how many there are. But for Charvaka, when we talk about mental states, perceptions, feelings, etc., what we're really talking about is something that emerges through combinations of elements. In the same way, they use this analogy of making beer. You put some grain and some water and some yeast together, and you get this new power that wasn't there in any of the original ingredients. You can drink all the water you want, eat all the grain you want, take some yeast, enjoy, but that's not going to get you buzzed. Whereas you put them together and this new power emerges, but it's not really new, it's just the result of the combination of those elements. So there's nothing more to the intoxicating power of beer than just the four elements. It's all the four elements, everything. And the same is true of consciousness and other mental phenomena. Now, the Buddhists hated the Charvaka. They are, one of the first opponents that any Buddhist philosopher will take on is Charvaka, precisely because they are physicalists. And what's wrong with being a physicalist in the eyes of the Buddhists? Well, the standard critique of Charvaka is they're immoralists. They really say these things because they want to have illegitimate sex. They want to have sex outside of the confines of marriage and family. Okay, that's what they're really all about. And why do Buddhists think that's the real motivation behind this Charvaka belief? Because if Charvaka is right, there is no such thing as rebirth. The karma rebirth ideology goes down the tubes if there's nothing more to us than our bodies, because even though it's conceivable that when I die and this body rots or gets burnt up or whatever, it's conceivable that a new being will come into existence that will suffer because of all the evil things I did in this life, like, for instance, teach Buddhist physicalism. It's conceivable that that might happen. It seems highly unlikely if all there is to us is just the elements or whatever final physics says there is. So it's the karma rebirth ideology that's central to Buddhist rejection of Charvaka materialism, which is the one materialism that they knew of. Although Vasubandhu did say at one point, this is kind of an aside in the third chapter of Abhidhamma Kosavaccha, this is when Vasubandhu was still a Sautrantika, he did say that materialism is in fact conducive to liberation. By liberation he meant attaining nirvana, overcoming suffering by getting dissolving the I sense, which is what the Buddhist project is all about. But karma rebirth, of course, plays a very important role in Buddhist practice. I hate to sound cynical, but it does play an important role in the material support of Buddhist institutions. Because what do lay followers do when they go to the Buddhist temple and, they offer alms, they make a donation. Why? Because they want to get the good karma through supporting the Buddhist institutions that will they can then donate to their recently deceased relative, their father, their mother, even their child, to make sure that they get a better rebirth. So belief in the karma rebirth ideology does play an important role in Buddhist institutions. It also, though, obviously plays a central role in the idea of a Buddha as someone who is able to make this, achieve this breakthrough understanding of the roots of suffering, because the Buddha was on the Bodhisattva path for countless prior lives and accumulating the merit that made it possible to have this great insight. And of course, in Mahayana Buddhism, Bodhisattva ideal becomes what everyone aspires to, not just exceptional individuals. And so it plays an important part in Buddhist thought. And of course, nirvana is quite commonly represented as escape from rebirth, escape from this perpetual cycle of being born, living your life, and then dying, and then being reborn based on the good or evil acts that you carried out in this life. But there are other reasons to be anti-physicalist. For instance, this whole idea of meditation. When the Dalai Lama spoke of Buddhism as a 2,500-year-old mind science, he had in mind the practice of meditation and the ways in which it's thought to give us insight into how mental phenomena work. And if meditation is a mind science, that would at least suggest it has its own special object of scientific investigation, namely mental phenomena. He, of course, was contrasting that with the physical sciences of the West. Okay. So that's one reason, but there's also, particularly among modern critics of physicalism in general, there's this worry about zombies. Now, philosophers have a very special conception of zombies. Don't think Hollywood zombies, don't think zombie apocalypse. Instead, think creatures that are physically and behaviorably indistinguishable from normal human beings. You walk up to a zombie, you engage in conversation with them, you're not going to notice any difference. There's nothing weird about them. The only difference between a normal human being and a zombie, according to this conception, is it's all dark inside. There's nothing going on in here. They behave the same way, they talk the same way, they act the same way, but it's all dark inside. There is nothing it's like to be a zombie. That's the philosopher's notion of a zombie. And many people are anti-physicalist because they think if physicalism is true, we are all zombies. There's really nothing going on. This idea of ours that there are these mental things going on, that's all an illusion. And if it's an illusion, doesn't that somehow undermine what is most valuable to us? And when philosophers talk about this, what it's like, they always give cases of individual sensory experiences, and it's always of a particular sort. For instance, the taste of the Pinot Noir, savoring the taste of that fine Bourgogne. If we were zombies, that wouldn't exist, and that's awful. So, don't we want to preserve what's most important, most valuable to us? Now, this is common among the people who are zombie phobes, and I'm mostly talking about philosophy. But I do know of some of the people who are anti-Buddhist physicalism, anti this project of naturalizing Buddhism, that they share in this idea that if physicalism is true, you get rid of the Nama Dharmas, then what's most valuable in human existence is lost. Okay, so that's something I think is worth keeping in mind. Now, how am I doing on time, by the way? This doesn't...
25.
Oh, yeah, okay.
35 more.
Let me talk some about the role of ontology in the Buddhist project, because, I mean, I've already said, physicalism is a kind of serious, it's a project of serious ontology. And what's that to do with the Buddhist project? Because isn't the Buddhist project all about achieving the cessation of suffering? Overcoming the I sense, getting rid of the source of our existential angst. Isn't that what nirvana is really all about? I know people often say it's really just getting off the wheel of samsara, but the wheel of samsara doesn't have to be understood in terms of rebirth, getting off, getting, escaping rebirth. It can be understood just in terms of getting out of the Ponzi scheme that our search for happiness amounts to. And I'll say a little bit more about that later on. Okay, now, why might Vasubandhu have said that Charvaka, these ancient Indian materialists, were teaching something that is in fact conducive to liberation? Well, nirvana is the cessation of existential suffering. And the fundamental Buddhist, the Buddha's insight was, I think, that the source of existential suffering is our false belief that there is an I, the I sense, the ahankara. That's what gets us hung up, and that's what leads to existential suffering. And Charvaka is like the Buddhists in denying the existence of a self. If there is nothing more to a person than the four elements, one of the elements is, in fact, a self. And so there is no self. There's just this body and this brain, all these elements put together in these interesting, complicated ways. Now, if the way to achieve nirvana is to get rid of the I sense, and let me say a word about why I think that's the best way of understanding nirvana. It has to do with this business of life as we ordinarily live it, as enrolling us in a hedonic Ponzi scheme. What do we all want? We all want happiness. Mere pleasure is nice, but happiness is better. There's a difference. happiness is what you get when your sense of your current situation says good things about who you are and where you are going. I like what I heard just said because it made me feel vindicated, because it turns out I was right to have this thought. And that in turn suggests that maybe I have a career in this strange stuff called philosophy, whatever. Okay. Imagine different scenarios in your own case. That's what we all want. We want happiness. And happiness, unfortunately, the quest for happiness amounts to a kind of Ponzi scheme that will ultimately, inevitably collapse, as all Ponzi schemes do, because there is not an infinite number of potential investors who can feed the scheme. Okay? Why is the happiness-seeking project a Ponzi scheme? Because we're going to die. Sorry to break it to you, but we are all going to die. Sooner or later, I hope it's later, but we will. And the happiness-seeking project requires an open future. This situation says good things about who I am and where I am going. And where am I going? To the funeral ground, to the crematory. Okay? That's where I'm going in the end. That realization undermines the happiness-seeking project, and that's where existential angst comes from. And that's what I think the Buddha was actually trying to address. You see this in the story of the four signs, which is a standard part of the Buddha's biography. Actually, you don't find this in the Nikayas. What you find is the four signs showing up in the story of an earlier Buddha. But the four signs are, okay, the situation is this young prince is, because his parents want him to live a lovely, happy life, only surrounded by healthy, attractive young people. He lives in the most pleasant of circumstances. But he goes out hunting one day and he happens to see an old person. Never seen an old person before. I guess his parents are still young. And then he goes out hunting the next day and he sees a sick person. And then the next day he sees a corpse. And then the fourth day he sees a wandering monk, a wandering mendicant, a shramana. And those four signs are what lead this young, actually bodhisattva, to renounce his life of pleasure as a prince and go off, and he becomes a shramana himself and goes to various teachers seeking the solution to the problem of suffering. What I think is going on in that story is precisely this business of the realization that this life, no matter how pleasant the circumstances, is a kind of hedonic Ponzi scheme. Okay, so that's my take on what's going on there. Now, in order to undermine that project, what do we have to do? Get rid of the sense of a me that is the owner of this life, about whom there can be this anxiety, this angst about its long-term prospects. And so the ahankara, the I sense, becomes the central target of Buddhist philosophical practice and Buddhist meditational practice as well. Okay? Buddhist practice, I think, is principally concerned to help us get rid, or at least see through, the I sense as, in some sense, delusory, as an illusion, as moha. Now, what could be the source of the I sense? Well, there are two possibilities. One is a self, understood the way the Astika schools like Nyaya and Mimamsa understood, Sankhya for that matter understood it, as one simple entity that persists, that endures through time, and is the subject of experience and agent of actions. But the other possibility is that, no, it's not, the self is not a soul pellet. It's not some little Cartesian thing, non-physical thing. Instead, it's a composite. Or better yet, given that part of the Buddha's insight was that everything is impermanent, a causal series of psychophysical elements, body parts and mind parts. And of course, the name for that is Pugala. Buddhist texts rarely distinguish between these two different senses of self, or senses of possible sources of the I sense. But you can nonetheless see them going back and forth. Most commonly, the target is the notion of the asat, what I'm calling the Atman, as a simple entity. But they do tend to work, want to work on both. They want to deny that either of those, strictly speaking, exists, belongs in our ultimate, our serious ontology. Now, it's obviously very counterintuitive to think that I don't exist. So, what do Buddhists have to do? They have to use argumentation and analysis. And this is how Buddhist philosophy comes to be. They're doing serious ontology. Now, how do we do this? Well, there are two distinct denials. One, basically ruling out the possibility of a Cartesian self, and the other, ruling out the existence of a person as a composite thing, as a whole made of parts. Now, the self, the Buddha argues quite extensively in the Nikayas, is simply unreal. Just end of story. Ain't no such thing. What are the arguments? Well, two arguments, one from impermanence, one from control. I won't go into the details. Most of you will know of them. If not, it's easy enough to find. The person is a little different. Vasubandhu's ninth chapter includes a lengthy refutation of this, what I would call a Buddhist heresy of Pugalavada, the real existence of a person. The person, according to classical Abhidharma, is not ultimately real, but is conventionally real. This distinction between ultimately real and conventionally real is very important. Ultimately real means belongs in our final ontology, result of doing serious ontology. Whereas to say of something it's conventionally real is to say that it's in our folk ontology, but it's not necessarily to be found in our serious ontology, our ultimate ontology. It's not ultimately real. Now, why is the person not ultimately real? Because a person is a composite. It's a whole made of parts. And no composite entity, nothing that's made of parts, is, strictly speaking, real. Now, when Buddhists say that, what they are doing is they are embracing something called myriological nihilism. Now, we've all heard the term nihilism. We don't like it. It's supposed to be something bad. But myriological nihilism is a serious philosophical thesis. Here's what it amounts to. It's basically saying nothing composite, nothing made of parts is, strictly speaking, real. It's just something we believe exists because it's useful for us to have a way of talking about these parts when they're arranged in this way. And there's an argument for this, but we're running short on time, so you've got the argument in your handout. The only part of the argument that might be a little difficult is the this line here. Suppose we say that the whole is real and the parts are real too. How then is this whole, for instance, a bicycle, related to the parts? Because if the bicycle is real and the parts are real, then you have a bicycle located where those parts are. And usually we say one physical thing and another real physical thing can't be located same place at the same time. So how exactly does that work? How can the whole be co-located with the parts? And one possible answer, if we say that the whole is distinct from the parts, is to say that, well, the bicycle as a whole is not entirely located where that pedal is. It's only partly located where that pedal is. But then, okay, that means the bicycle, distinct from the pedal and the handlebars and the wheels and so on, that bicycle itself can be carved up into these different regions. The bicycle itself, as opposed to the pedal, itself has these different regions, a pedal-shaped region, for instance, and it's located in the same place as the pedal is. But now, you just said that the bicycle has this little region within it. And that's what we mean when we say something is a part of something else. So you just introduced a second kind of parts. And that's where we get the parts sub two. And then the question is, how is the bicycle as a whole related to its parts of two? It turns out we need parts of three. And so on and so on and so on. Infinitely. Okay, so that's how that argument is supposed to work. So bicycles are things we believe exist only because it's useful for us to have one word to talk about all those parts when those parts are put together in the right way. This is what this... I like to think of this as the first Buddhist philosopher other than the Buddha, this nun, this bhikkhuni Vajira, who was one of the was talking in the presence of the Buddha and came up with basically this argument, basically said, look, words like chariot and forest and city and person, those are just useful ways of talking about many things when they're put together in the right way. It's a mere enumerative expression. Now, okay, where does this leave us when it comes to doing ultimate ontology, serious ontology, as Buddhists? If we accept mereological nihilism, what is left? Because can't you divide up absolutely everything into parts, and then those parts have parts, and so on and so on? I mean, the pedal of that bicycle is made up of lots of molecules, and those molecules are made up of atoms, and those atoms are made up of subatomic particles, and so on and so forth. Well, okay. According to mereological realism, well, it entails that only simple things are ultimately real. But what are simple things? What are the dharmas, to use the Buddhist expression? And the standard Buddhist answer is, a dharma is that entity whose concept still applies after separation and analysis. This is what Vasubandhu says. Take the example of the chariot. The concept, the term chariot, no longer applies when we take the chariot apart. We break it down into the individual wheels and the axle and the felly and the cotter pins and so on. Okay, so that means we're down to, it looks like we're down to atoms, which are, okay, the word atom literally means partless. So we have to imagine physical particles that cannot themselves be divided up into parts. Okay, the things we call atoms aren't really atoms. Okay, physicists made a mistake in the 19th century, but never mind. The word atom literally means partless. Take a water atom. Well, that can be divided not into different spatial regions, but rather, because it has none, it's too small to cut up, but it can nonetheless be analyzed conceptually into an occurrence of a certain shape, an occurrence of a certain colorlessness, an occurrence of a certain stickiness. That's the tangibility property of water. Those are the dharmas, the round shape, the colorless, the wetness. Those are property particulars. Where we say there is a water atom, there is a bundle of those property particulars, what Nyaya calls gunas, or what in modern metaphysics are called tropes. My apology to the lit crit majors, because they use the word trope to mean something very different. A dharma is then an entity whose nature is intrinsic. That is, it has that nature, it is that way, independently of everything else in the world. That nature is its own, sva, cognate to the word self. And so a dharma is something that could exist in the lonely state, the unaccompanied state, could be what it is, even if nothing else existed at all at that moment. Now, dharmas are all momentary, so we only talk about one moment, because that's all a dharma has to its life. But it could exist in that state, be what it is, without anything else existing. That's the claim. So you can think of dharmas as momentary trope occurrences. Now, what kinds of dharmas are there? Here we're getting to serious Abhidharma ontology. Classical Buddhist realists are dualists, and then there are monists. The dualists, some claim that there are five kinds of dharmas, the five skandhas, rupa, and the four nama dharmas. And then there are others who say, no, there are really just two. There's just rupa and then vijnana. And then there are the Yogacharans who are idealists. They say there's really just one, namely consciousness. But a Buddhist physicalist would say, well, they would agree with Yogacara. There's just one kind of dharma. But for them, the one kind of dharma is physical, not mental, but physical. Now, a Buddhist physicalist can say that mental events are conventionally real. There really are such things as feelings, perceptions, consciousness exists, there are thoughts, memories, and so on. Those things are conventionally real. It's useful for us to be able to refer to them. We're going to talk about that some tomorrow. But what they are is really just very complex arrangements of the whatever the physical constituents are that make up our neurons that fire in these very complicated ways. Now, they can say all that, but this still makes the karma rebirth idea very implausible. And it would also rule out the idea of meditation as mind science, because meditation turns out not to be the best way of investigating what's going on in the brain. We now have fMRI scans that can, in fact, do a certain very rudimentary form of mind reading, of, in fact, saying exactly what mental state the subject is in, what they're thinking about. Okay, so, and that's the situation with Buddhist physicalism, how it lines up against classical Abhidharma and Yogacara views of what we are like. Looking ahead, what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow. So far, I've just got the Buddhist physicalists on one side, and then all the other Buddhist serious ontologists, the Abhidharma schools and Yogacara on the other side, and we've got this clash. We disagree about lots of stuff, not just what there is in reality, strictly speaking, but also whether there is such a thing as karma and rebirth, and how we might go about overcoming the I sense. Do I have any good arguments against, okay, what I'm calling Buddhist, classical Buddhist inner world realism? Okay, when people talk about idealism, they contrast that with external world realism, that is, the view that there are physical objects. There's not just the world in here, there's also a world out there. Yogacara Chittamatra says, no, there isn't. Berkeley said, no, there isn't. There's just the world in here. Dualists, people like Descartes, but also like the classical Abhidharma schools, Theravada, Vaibhashika, Saitrantika, Mahasanghika, etc., they also said that there is, in addition to the external world, rupa, there is an inner world, consciousness and the chitta and the chaita dharmas. You can then lump Yogacara and the classical Abhidharma schools together under this term internal world realism. They're realist about the mental. It really exists. It belongs in our serious ontology. Those things are ultimately real. Are there difficulties for that? Well, that's one question I want to address. That will be the real focus of my talk tomorrow morning. And what I'm basically going to say is, well, remember the svabhava criterion for something's being a dharma, being ultimately real. It must have its nature intrinsically. It cannot be something that is a mereological sum, the result of putting this part and that part together and then sticking a label on the two or more things when they are together. It cannot be like that. It must be something whose whole nature is intrinsic to that thing. Does an internal realist have trouble with that? Now, just a quick preview of the difficulty that I think is the internal realist Buddhist face. It has to do with non-self. Because what all Buddhists agree on is that there is no such thing as the subject of experience, the agent of actions, the thing that is aware and the thing that pulls the trigger that makes action happen. There is no such thing. And so experience has no subject. There are conscious mental states, according to Buddhist internal world realists, but there is no owner of those states, no thing that has those states. And the Nyayikas and Mimamsakas and Sankhins all criticize the Buddhists for exactly this reason. They think it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever to suppose there could be mental states without there being a subject that has those states. Think of the mind as, in terms of this image of the Cartesian theater. It's a theater where, okay, there's a projector which projects images on the screen. And where do those images come from? Well, at least some of them come from cameras outside the theater that are bringing in input from what's going on out there. There's an audio system that produces sound over the loudspeakers, and those sounds are likewise coming from microphones out there in the world. And there's one more thing, in addition to the screen where the images are projected, the loudspeaker where the sound comes from, there's the audience. There's one person in the audience who's watching and listening. Okay? And what Nyaya and Sankhya and Mimamsa and many modern critics of Buddhism all claim is that the whole idea of mental events happening without there being that watcher in the audience simply makes no sense. Okay? Now, some of my best friends are Nyayikas, and they really do believe that this makes absolutely no sense, and I've come to really shock them by agreeing with them that there is, in fact, a problem with this notion of ownerless mental states, at least if we follow Buddhist metaphysical scruples. And that's what I'm going to be doing tomorrow, but that's not to say I want to stick that Cartesian ego back in the audience of the Cartesian theater. No. The alternative is to go physicalist, okay? And that's what my talk in the afternoon is going to get at. What I will do then in the afternoon is try to explore how a Buddhist physicalism might try to deal with the challenges. One challenge to any physicalism is the so-called hard problem of explaining away phenomenal consciousness, that what it is like. How can you say there is nothing it's like to taste the peanut raw? Okay, how can you possibly do that? And here's another problem that a Buddhist physicalist might face. Meditation isn't mind science, according to a Buddhist physicalist. Why then does it work? Why is it a useful way of trying to overcome the I sense, the ahankara? And finally, can there be a Buddhist path without the karma rebirth idea, which I'd like to address that question as well. Okay, so I'll stop.
Great, thank you very much. So, we've got plenty of time for comments, questions, critical objections. Sylvia.
Thank you for any question, but I will start. It's good to give you a question. So do you use the term teleological nihilism? Do you use the term teleological nihilism interchangeably with teleological reductionism? And what do you think about the interpretation that kind of popular again now that Buddhism is eliminativist about the self or eliminativist about the Buddha?
I still...
So what do you think about the interpretations that are kind of popular again now, that Buddhism is the eliminativist about the self?
Eliminativism, as philosophers nowadays use that term, means that this word, this concept, should be eliminated from our discourse. And reductionism is the alternative to that, which says this term should not be eliminated from our discourse, but instead understood as just a useful way of talking about something else. Now, what I have often characterized the Abhidharma Project as is a reductionism about persons. Persons as, and that's basically what I was presenting today. Persons, the concept of a person is a useful way of bundling together a causal series of arrangements of psychophysical elements. You put the skandhas together, they only exist for a moment. These dharmas, these rupa dharmas, these nama dharmas, they only exist for a moment, but when they go out of existence, they will call successor dharmas. That a causal series of such arrangements of dharmas, that's what we conveniently designate as a person. If we didn't have that word, we'd have a really, really hard time of it. And that's why the word should not be eliminated. It should be reduced. Retain it in our ordinary common sense vocabulary, our folk ontology, but learn to see through it, to understand that there is really nothing more than just these dharmas in this causal series. And that's all we're really talking about when we talk about persons, me and you and everyone else. Retain the word, because otherwise, if we were trying as Buddhas or as Bodhisattvas to help others overcome suffering by seeing that, strictly speaking, there is no I, the I sense is in fact a kind of trap, how would we talk to them? How would we address them? How do you do that if the only way you can talk about someone is by listing each of the skandhas that makes them up at that instant, and then, oh, there are some more in the next instant, so you couldn't do it. This is why what we call enumerative expressions, like the word dozen, that's an enumerative expression, are so useful. This is why we use them. You go to the grocery store, you want a dozen eggs. Do you have to say egg, 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 egg? No. You say, give me a dozen eggs, and you're done. Much easier. Okay? So eliminativism strikes me as a serious mistake. Of course, persons are not to be found in our ultimate ontology. We're muriological nihilists now. We were convinced by that argument about chariots. Okay? But we still need to be able to use the concept. Now, though, we understand that it is, in fact, a mere concept that we employ because it's convenient, given our interests and our cognitive limitations. When we're doing serious ontology, we want to dismiss our interests and our cognitive limitations and just investigate how the world itself really is. So we don't talk about persons at the ultimate level. But then if we want to talk about a person, we're going to have a really hard time. We don't need to do that because we have that background in the back of our minds. We understand that this conventional way of referring to these things is perfectly fine as long as you can see through it. See it for the mere useful device it is. That's why I think and saying person should be eliminated rather than reduced is a mistake. Okay? Thank you for the question.
Please.
I was just wondering if there is a problem to do with the combination of dharmas. If dharmas are these things that have these intrinsic distinct properties from other dharmas, how they could combine with other dharmas without sharing some commonality with them. And if they had that commonality, then it would seem like they're not irreducible, because they would then have two properties.
It's just the way the causal laws happen to work. It's all causation. The only real relation in Buddhist ontology is causation. That's it. And it's through causal connections that these dharmas go out of existence and they cause these other dharmas to come into existence. It's through a causation that when this sort of dharma arises, something else arises alongside it. Those kinds of causal connections are what explain the regularities that we capture in our ordinary our common sense ontology.
So it isn't the case that the dharmas are combined to start with, they're just everything's just alongside each other.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all happenstance. And, you know, good for lucky for us. Now, a modernist Buddhist physicalist could, in fact, bring in not just the laws of final physics, but also bring in all sorts of stuff from evolutionary, from biology, from evolutionary biology, and explain how these particular physical constituents wound up being occurring in these particular combinations. You can do that. And all of that can be explained ultimately in terms of final physics, the ideas. It's just, it's a very, very complicated story. We start with whatever the entities are that are the bound variables and go in the bound variable slot in the laws of final physics. And then you, okay, in Newtonian mechanics, for instance, you go from occurrences of mass, point instance of mass, to particles. And then particles that combine to form molecules, and so on and so on. And it's only at a very high level that you get biology. But remember, biology reduces to biochemistry, which reduces to physical chemistry, which reduces to blah, 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 until you get to final physics. there are many different layers in the modern scientific worldview. And persons are going to be at the very top. Our common sense ontology is going way, way up here. And you go many, many layers down until you get to quantum physics. So it's going to be very, very complicated. But nonetheless, given, I mean, think about the breakthroughs that this approach to doing biology has conferred on us. Think about the medical miracles that have been performed just in the last 100 years because of the understanding that this sort of system is made up of organs, which are made up of tissues, which are made up of cells, which are in turn made up of molecules, which are in turn made up of atoms, etc., etc. You go down from one layer to the next, you get a better understanding of how this higher level thing actually works, and so you get a better understanding of how to intervene to make it do what we want. That's the picture. That's the appeal of the naturalist stance, the physicalist stance.
Right, I have only first and then Fargo.
Thanks so much, Professor Tedderitz. So I have a question just about your, just internal to your conceptualization of like Abhidharma Dharma theory. It seems like you were saying that at least in some schools of Abhidharma, there's something akin to a Cartesian dualism with physical dharmas and mental dharmas, jitta dharmas.
Not a Cartesian dualism, a dualism.
Okay. But I would ask that, it seems that you were talking about dharmas in general and you said that they were momentary trope occurrences. It seems to me in that definition that there's something intrinsically qualitative about dharmas.
A dharma just is the occurrence of a property particular, a quality particular. An occurrence of blue, an occurrence of heat, here, now, heat, here, now, blue.
And so you think you can have those qualities without any subjectivity?
There is no substance in Abhidharma ontologies, no thing that bears the qualities. They're just the property particulars, or what metaphysicians nowadays call tropes.
So it works the other way around. So you start with the property predictors, and then they congregate in order to form individuals, rather than you have an individual with properties, and then you sort of pull the property out. Right? Sure. It's just this order of dependence. Okay, yes.
Thank you so much.
Speak
I'm going to come back
here.
Okay. I'll let you speak up anyway, so right. Everyone can hear you.
Thank you so much.
I don't have it in my head. I've got it somewhere on my computer. If you email me, I'll send you the link.
Right. So, yeah, yes.
The last part correctly. The basic question you're getting at is how important is the karma rebirth ideology to Buddhism or to
So do you think Buddhist philosophy would be quite different if they would not be dependent on the
deity
for
us as an
institution?
In fact, it's occurred to me recently that one way of thinking about, I was going to talk about this tomorrow, but I'll throw this out today. One way of thinking about the role of the karma rebirth ideology in classical Indian Buddhism is analogous to the role that the state took on when it abrogated power of what we call criminal justice. What was the point of the state saying, basically, okay, here are the laws, here are the rules that hold throughout our nation, and we, the state, have the power to punish lawbreakers, those who break those rules. What was the point of doing that? Well, of course, you might be cynical and say, well, it was just, you know, the king wanting to make sure that no one pillaged his stuff. But you might instead see it in a more interestingly functionalist way, political functionalist way, as a way of trying to ensure social stability by taking the power of response to perceived wrongdoing out of the hands of the clan, out of the hands of the family, and preventing thereby revenge killing. Preventing these ongoing feuds between clans, between families, that prevailed in fact, nowadays still prevail in some cultures. The state, by taking on the job of enforcement of criminal justice, the institution of criminal justice, was out to enhance social stability by preventing that sort of internal warfare. Now, think about the Karma Reaper's ideology as something consumed by ordinary lay people. The Buddha is known to have only talked about Karma Reaper when talking to lay followers. When he talked to his those who had renounced householder existence and become monks and nuns, followers of the Buddha's path, he talked about non-self, didn't talk a whole lot about karma and reaper. Why might that be? Well, one possibility is if ordinary people understand karma and rebirth as something that will lead to the person that they're angry at because they harmed me, that person will in fact suffer, if not in this life, then in the future life. That diminishes my sense of wanting to enact revenge on that person who I perceive as having wronged me. And revenge is one of the kleshas. It's anger. One of the defilements that is a defilement is recognized as such in Buddhist psychology because it reinforces the I sense. It reinforces the sense of there being a me who has these interests of this other person, in fact, and somehow harmed and naturally, I want to have revenge. I want to make them suffer in the way I've been made to suffer. If we believe in karma and rebirth, we might be slightly less likely to worry about that. I know in my own case, I guess it's okay for me to talk this way because I'm not in the United States right now. For so many of the years of the Trump administration, I was so angry at the various evil things that he and his minions were doing. But then I began to think about what life must be like for the ultimate narcissist, Donald Trump. How narcissism is actually the cardinal expression of existential suffering, of dukkha. I mean, you can, if you think about it, you can see it on his face. He is so angry so much of the time. Of course, he's found a way to make use of that anger and instill that anger in others. But he himself is clearly consumed by suffering. And so I'm not no longer quite so angry. The karma rebirth ideology could, I think, be thought of as doing something similar for Buddhist lay followers. Diminishing the level of this particular klesha, the anger, the desire for revenge, making them more likely over the course of a lifetime to actually achieve at least some diminution of their own existential suffering. In other words, the karma rebirth ideology is a vulnerable pile. And the Buddha is known as someone who is a consummate teacher with great, great pedagogical skill because he always knew exactly what to say for any given audience that would help them make progress toward overcoming suffering. And that skill is referred to as upaya, upaya kaushala, beneficial methods. Beneficial pedagogical methods. Maybe the karma rebirth teaching, as addressed to lay followers, is a case of that. That strikes me as one way, one Buddhist physicalist response to this question.
If I may just slightly debate me a little bit. So thank you very much, this is all very fascinating. And I just have a few general kind of, arguments when I hear about this kind of analysis of like Buddhist doctrine. And in terms of like just understanding what is the difference between mind and body or physicalism and more traditional forms of understanding the nature of a human. And I just remember this one thing that Dalai Lama often says in this kind of discussions of that, well, if you want to know if the mind is physical, to spend enough time meditating on your own mind, and sooner or later you'll notice it has qualities that are utterly distinct from anything that you perceive with your senses. And so this brings me to think of basic core Abhidharma doctrines that show that mind, it's a mental dharma, it's not an object of senses, it's an object of mind. Right? So that's the mind as described in all Buddhist Indian books. If we then use a different type of methodology which it does not accept that and thereby puts the cart before the horse in the sense that we'll understand mind by using our senses and by using reason alone, then we're kind of begging the question. Right? And so that's kind of one kind of problem I think I find with sometimes this analysis. The other is that when we beg the question in that way, and we put the cart before the horse and we don't accept core qualities of mental dharmas as described in the tradition we're analysing, and we assume they have others, we also ignore a certain type of methodology that is intrinsic to Buddha Dharma in terms of the types of mental states that are able to actually access mental dharmas. Yeah, like the methodology of actually using heightened meditative states to understand things and to understand the qualities of dharmas. So if we no longer accept a certain type, or if we don't use a certain type of methodology in how we analyze the qualities of an intrinsic subject, as described by tradition, we use other methodologies with other assumptions, then surely we're doing kind of disservice. I understand the heuristic values of it, but they're my two main arguments there.
See, the claim the Buddhist physicalist would make is you can have virtually everything that you just said in terms of the methodologies. Now, there are those who would dispute that particular description of methodologies. For instance, Susan Blackmore, who is herself a long-term meditator, was also a cognitive scientist. Encounters all sorts of difficulties when it comes to understanding meditative methodologies in that sense. But leaving that aside, you can have all that, the physical Switzer, but understand that as revealing something about the workings of this physical mechanism. This physical mechanism, it turns out, has this meta-capacity that makes it possible to, for what we think of as one mental state to reveal the structures of other mental states, etc., etc. Interesting capacity, but a capacity that can be understood in, and straightforwardly, in very complex and neurophysiological terms. So, and see, a lot of Buddhist arguments are couched in terms of what I call the principle of lightness. To Western philosophers, it's known as Occam's razor, the principle of parsimony, don't posit more than you absolutely have to in order to make your theory work. And the Buddhist physicalist would say, yeah, you can have all those things that you think you need in order to understand how meditation is efficacious, but those things can in fact be understood without putting those entities, the entities of the internal world realist, into your final ontology, your serious ontology. That's what they're going to say. Now, the details of this obviously all need to be thrashed out, and we're not going to do that this afternoon, I'm sure. But that's the sort of approach that they're going to take. And really, we're in early days when it comes to natural physicalist mind science, because we're only just beginning to be able to use fMRIs to capture what's going on in the supposedly sacrosanct inner private realm of the mind. But we can begin to be able to do that, and we can see how, at least in principle, it might be possible to do it in a more thorough way.
Might be.
just kind of following up on this discussion now, I guess I would ask, are we exercising parsimony when you say that you would allow, for example, all of the things that were just brought up, the possibility of studying and accessing certain mental phenomena from within using mental methods, whatever, but then explain that by appealing to the mechanism of the physical body, as it were. Is that really a parsimonious act to say that we accept that the possibility of investigating these phenomena, but that we are in turn explaining that by referring to something further, that is this idea about the physical body as a further entity, almost, as it were, beyond the mental?
One important detail of reduction in the sciences that I've left out is you have unification. Unification of different bodies of evidence, presumably about different sorts of things, at a higher level, turn out to be unified once we see that these things over here and these things over there are really just this one sort of thing at this lower level. Like what happened with light and heat and magnetism with Maxwell's equations. Okay? We used to think of magnetism and light and heat as three completely different phenomena, very mysterious phenomena if you think about them hard enough. But it turns out they're really just one phenomenon. And that's where the appeal to simplicity or lightness comes in. Because you don't need quite so many different kinds of things if you can reduce this theory over here and this theory over here and this theory. You can unify them in terms of simpler entities at a lower level. So that's how the physicalist would approach this mind science as something other than natural, that is physical science, how the Buddhist physicalists would respond to.
Alice, is that a hand? Yes? Yeah? Try to speak up, please.
Okay, I was actually being kind of facetious when I talked about isn't the ability to taste that fine Pinot Noir the sort of thing that we most value in life? I was being sort of facetious. Because a Buddhist, first of all, Buddhists would not be in the business of drinking Pinot Noir. Can't drink alcohol. Sorry. I'm not a Buddhist, by the way. They would see that sort of appeal to what we most value in life as, in fact, an expression of the essence. There's something distinctive, special about being human. Well, which is not to say that, you know, we should treat other human beings the way we treat rocks or trees or let alone animals, for those who are carnivores. But there's a reason for that. I won't go into where I think all Buddhists come down on the question of the source of values. It's really all to do with suffering is bad and it's to be prevented, regardless of when and where it occurs. And that's all I think you need to keep the values that are most important to us alive and afloat at the conventional level. The worry about it's all being dark outside, dark inside, shouldn't be a worry for a Buddhist if you take the Buddhist analysis of the I sense seriously as the source of suffering. And that's why I was being slightly ironic when I talked about savoring the taste of the Pinot Noir, because that is, in fact, just an expression of there's something special about me, unlike those peasants who, you know, drink that swill instead of these fine, noble wines. That's something that has to be gotten rid of, has to be extirpated. And the sooner we get rid of it, the better. That's not to say, though, that there won't be any pleasure whatsoever in the life of someone who has extirpated or at least seen through the eyes. There will be. It just won't be a source of pride, a source of fulfillment, none of that. Instead, it will just be pleasure occurring here and now. End of story. So that's what I actually think liberation is really all about.
Well, I think this is a good place to stop, and so we can move on now to the pleasures of refreshment. Mark is probably not happy if we ask him to dedicate the merit of all of that, so we'll just ask him for a round of applause. Yes. Thank you very much.
I'm the one who needs merit, because I'm obviously doing Mara's work.
Right, so for those who want to come for more of this, it's going the talk number 2 is going to be tomorrow at 10:30, also here, and then talk number 3 tomorrow, 2 o'clock, also here. Yeah? Thank you. Right, okay, take your thing out, right? So
let me close it out.
So, and we can switch that off. Yeah, and then we can see.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your
Jacob,
question.
Jacob, I'm one of Jan's PhD students.
Yeah, yeah.
Real pleasure. I really hope I can come to both of your talks tomorrow. Unfortunately, I've got other thing I'm supposed to be doing in the morning, but I should be there for the afternoon.
We are going to record. I mean.